I got into this topic because I really appreciate the beauty of the natural world that we have. And I wanted to figure out a way that we can try and quantify that from a healthcare perspective to see what is it about that that we can harness or utilize and incorporate in people's lives to ultimately enrich them and enrich their communities. And I found out kind of that there were a few items of research on this topic when I was in school and kind of followed that thread as it unraveled. When I first got started, I literally had everything that was published on the topic, hard copy, because this was before PDFs existed, and there was, you know, a stack of maybe that many. And now there are multiple, you know, hundreds, maybe even a couple thousands, because I still keep track of all of them. And it's just been amazing to watch the field grow. So I'm going to just review a little bit of that. I'll try not to get too medical or anything like that, but you know, the main theme is not rocket science. You know, the general take-home message from all this is, you know, being in nature is good for us, and as much as we can do that, you know, depending on how you define it, we're going to be healthier, and our communities are going to be healthier. And so, I was just going to explore some of that. Start off with my shot here. Now, I never know where I'm going to be speaking, what the context, the setting is going to be like. A lot of times, I'm lecturing in conference halls where it's totally windowless in some downtown place somewhere. So there's a big irony that I'm talking about nature and it's not around. So of course, you know, beautiful Yosemite Valley here. Which, who all has been to Yosemite? Anybody? Been there?
Gorgeous.
It's amazing. You know, as with all, you know, nature photography, you know, all photography really, you know, pictures don't really do things justice. I mean, there's just a grandeur to these spaces that comes with it. But it's the best that I can recreate here. You know, and you know, I'm sure that, you know, I'm looking forward to going out and exploring around here. I'm here till Sunday, so I get to experience what y'all have down these ways that are, you know, just beautiful as well. This quote I really like: "Charm of natural scenery is an influence of the highest curative value, more than any single form of medication, to establish sound minds and sound bodies." And it really kind of encapsulates the gist of it. That, you know, just being out in the presence of these types of spaces gives us, you know, that soothing, what we call salutogenic effect, a healing kind of presence. This is Frederick Law Olmsted, a century and a half ago. So have any of y'all heard of Olmsted by chance? Yes.
He did the Biltmore Seder.
He did the Biltmore. That is correct. So he did a lot of different campuses and urban things around the country. He did Central Park. He did Stanford campus out in California. He did most of the Ivy, well, not the Ivies, but he did a lot of stuff. And it was his understanding that we need to incorporate natural spaces into our design, because if we don't, those are going to get lost. He was, you know, right, mid-19th century in New York, where he was seeing the initiation of urban development. New York City was just starting to, you know, Industrial Revolution was kicking in. Things were starting to really get developed. And he said, we need to consciously incorporate these natural spaces or else they're just going to be gone and then we'll have nothing. One of his other famous quotes, it talks about that. But it's very true. And you know, we can see more about that. And there's been other people have thought about this as a World Health Organization. You know, very interested in urban development as a health promotion or health determinant. You know, in this report on chronic disease, this is just a small statement. You know, the report itself is on all chronic disease overall. But, you know, a small section in there talks about the natural world as being a significant contributor to the rates of chronic disease. We know from a healthcare perspective, chronic disease is the big driver of healthcare costs, healthcare visits. You know, it's not, you know, infectious disease, which is what, you know, 100 years ago, you know, we were fighting off, you know, pneumonia and tuberculosis and things like that. And then along came antibiotics. So, you know, now we still get, you know, things, hepatitis and whatnot, but, you know, the big drivers of healthcare, you know, are chronic disease, heart disease, diabetes, you know, kidney failure, you know, arthritis, those types of things. And here we're showing that it is the natural world and our distance from it that really contributes to that. Certainly it's not the cause, but, you know, it is a contributor. So just to set the stage of my perspective, and I think y'all are going to be familiar with this because you're patients here at the clinic for integrative medicine, but not everybody's on board with that, as you may be aware. You know, that health is a, you know, is a holistic concept. So when we're talking about health and well-being, we're not just talking about physical health in terms of, well, I don't have any joint pain, I don't have a fever, I don't have a headache, but, you know, it's, well, how are we in our body and in our mind? And one of the definitions of health, actually the World Health Organization definition, says that health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being. The community is a vital part. If we just live alone and not connected to our neighbors, our family, and whatnot, that also is a major determinant of dis-ease, and we know a lot about that. I could give a whole talk about that. So that was the first part of the definition, and the second part of the definition of health is that health is not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Meaning health is more than just not being sick. Right? Health is a positive state that we try and cultivate. When you say, I'm feeling healthy, can you, do you enjoy your life? Are you feeling vibrant? Are you feeling full? Are you feeling appreciative of what you have, rather than just like, oh, you know, my back didn't hurt today, so I guess I'm healthy, or I didn't have my headache today, or whatnot. Health is a positive quality that we can cultivate. And the gist of all that is, that again, having an environmental context that supports that is critical. We know that in terms of determinants of health, again, healthcare, medical care here, is just a small percentage of what actually determines our health. Being able to go see a doctor regularly, get your checkup, get your drugs, even to some extent, supplements or nutrition. That's only a small percent of what determines our health and well-being. Genetics also plays a part. Health behaviors, smoking, do you exercise, physical activity, all that. But the biggest determinant of our health is, what we call social ecological factors. Again, community. Do we have friends? Do we have relationships of people that we care about and can confide in and share things with? And then what is the ecological, the environmental context in which we do that? We can't survive as a species without community. And that's one of the reasons, in public health, that's what we focus on is, not just the individual and their issues, but what are communities' issues? How does disease or health, how does it manifest in groups of people, and how can we change that through their dynamics? What is the physical context? There's a beautiful view out here that we have right behind me, which is really nice. It's this entire presentation, this vibe, like you sitting here looking at me, would have a different flavor to it, if there was, skyscrapers and construction and an industrial waste plant and everything like that behind me. So just some data. I won't get into this real quick. This is for people learning this. But this is a study that came out last year. This is a systematic review, so a compilation of studies. And what they ultimately found is that the rates of death from heart disease are lower for people that live closer to green space. And this is controlling for a bunch of other factors, the biggest one being socioeconomic status. So this wasn't just, the people that live in the nicer, greener places have more money, so they can afford to live in those places, but they also can afford better health care and trips to the Bahamas and all of that stuff. And so, they're going to be healthier. Controlled for all of that, and they've found it's just the proximity to the green space itself less likely to die from heart disease. For anybody that's into numbers and things like this, you know, there's 115 million people in this data set, which is, we like that. It's big data. So statistically significant, as they say. Also looked at lung disease as kind of a comparative and showed that there was no relationship with lung disease, which they didn't think there would be, but they wanted to rule that out. They would say, is it all disease in general? And they didn't find it with lung disease, meaning that it wasn't something about, well, yeah, people live in greener spaces, and so there's less urban, you know, exhaust and stuff like that. So that's what's doing it. It had nothing to do with what was in the air. It was the actual physical space itself. So, you know, people postulated for a long time about what this might be, what could be contributing to this, why this might be. And very smart guy, name of Richard Louvre, is an author, writer, who lives in San Diego. He came up with this idea of nature deficit disorder. Have any of y'all heard of this book? Yeah, one, two, yeah. So he really coined this term, nature deficit disorder. This isn't a diagnosable medical condition, right? This is not in the ICD-10. But it is conceptually something that is pretty simple to think about, which is that we have within us an inherent tendency to appreciate being outside. Kind of, it's just natural human state for the most part. You know, there are some people that are exceptions, you know, culturally. You know, if you weren't raised camping or hiking or any of those things, it's not going to be as valuable or appreciative of that as someone else. But for the most part, if given a choice, hey there! For the most part, if given a choice, we are going to gravitate toward those places. And that when we don't have that, we don't have access to that, that's something that we miss. We may not realize we miss it, but it's going to be a deficit, same as another vitamin, you know, vitamin C, vitamin A, vitamin D. So Louvre actually started calling nature, you know, vitamin N, that it is an essential nutrient that we need access to because of our inherent ability or inherent desire, interest for it. Another term that comes up a lot is this idea of biophilia, inherent love of other living things. This is E.O. Wilson. He's a biologist from Harvard. He's won lots of awards. He's a very, very smart guy. But he also came up with this understanding, this awareness, this idea that we have inherent within us an attraction, an affinity for other forms of life, whether that is, you know, the living world outside. You know, it's also why the internet is full of, you know, videos of, you know, little baby goats and kittens and stuff like that, is because it's just in us, right? If there's somebody out there that can watch a video of, you know, little baby, really anything, and not feel something, that's probably a pathology on their part, pretty much most people have this inherent affinity. And so we look at how to capitalize on that. So there's a couple different ideas that feed into how do nature deficit disorder and biophilia actually contribute to these rates of different diseases. Heart disease is just one. I could have showed you a whole lot more. Can you hand me my water? I'm sorry. I don't want to pull a Marco Rubio. Thanks. So there's a couple different mechanisms that are the connection between nature deficit disorder, biophilia, and actual disease states. And the biggest one is stress, the modulation of stress. There is this awareness growing, it's been growing for a while. You know, the stress is one of the principal contributors to chronic disease, and really most disease, but, you know, chronic disease is the main one that we look at. In medical terms, we call it psychoneuroimmunology or psychoneuroendocrinology. When I am feeling really saucy, when I was doing my postdoc and people ask me, oh, what's your research in? I would say I do biophilic environmental psychoneuroendocrinology. Which, you know, translated is the study of how the physical environment, particularly the natural world, modulates our stress response and the health implications of that. There's a lot of information about this, just not related to the nature specifically, but just stress. I'm sure some of you, in your own healthcare, look at stress management of some type. So anytime that people recommend, yoga, meditation, breath work, art classes, name it, crossword puzzles, whatever, knitting, exercise, all these things that modulate stress, there are a couple of specific ways that that helps us be healthier. These are just two resources that you can look up if you are interested in this. I don't know if the slides are available to people, or so you guys can get a copy of these. This is by far, I think, the most accessible. I recommend this all the time. It's a video, 1 hour. You can just Google it, it'll come up on YouTube. Has anybody seen it by chance? No. It's really great, gets into the nuts and bolts of stress and how it is affecting our physiology. Like I said, it only takes an hour. It's about, 2009, I think it came out, so it still holds up. There have been some advances since then, but the basics are all still there. Nothing in there is inaccurate. But it's a great way to understand when people talk about stress and how does it influence your health. This will tell you exactly what it's doing in terms of raising your blood pressure, cortisol, the stress hormone, those types of things. These are also some books that people can look at if they're interested. This one in particular, this is one of the premier guys that talks about stress and its impacts on health. He's actually in this video. Esther Sternberg, actually, she's in this video too. Just some resources for y'all. So in terms of how stress is modulated by our natural environment, we have what's called the psychoevolutionary stress theory. And the basic gist of it is that we are adapted over millions of years to be in the natural world, to be outdoors. If you think back to our history, where we come from, 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 1,000,000 years ago, our ancestors, yours and mine, were on an extended camping trip for their entire life, right? There was no indoors. There were vaguely cities, but they were like just trading posts, right? I mean, it's only been within the past couple thousand years, couple hundred years that we've had urban settings the way that we have them as we think of them today, which is absolutely nothing in terms of evolutionary time, right? Compared to the millions of years and the, tens of thousands of generations of our ancestors this is what they knew, right? They didn't know this. And so their bodies and their nervous systems were adapted to that. That's their baseline. That's their home. And that is one of the reasons why, going out, going camping, right? Camping is very relaxing for many people. Yes, if you're not used to it, people freak out. Am I going to get eaten by a bear? All that stuff. But once you get past that and you settle in, most people find it very relaxing, very therapeutic. Just sit around the campfire, listen, have the sun go down, listen to the crickets and all that, right? Yes? Okay, good. That's an inherent thing that's in us, and what psychoevolutionary stress theory says is we can utilize that in our modern life because we are all this predates nature deficit disorder, but ultimately nature deficit disorder is has displaced us from our baseline, and so we are all constantly at a slight level of agitation. We're adaptable beings. And so we're not all constantly in a you know, in a state of panic. But on a physiologic level, our nervous systems are not where, you know, in an optimal state compared to what they would like to be when you consider what are the sensory inputs, what is the level of light, what are the qualities of sound that are coming in through our ears, what are, you know, what is our contextual experience that is that optimal operating state. Won't get into this too much, but this is one of the central parts of stress, and if any of you've talked about stress management with, you know, a healthcare provider, they've probably talked about these two parts of your nervous system, what we call the sympathetic or fight or flight system, and the parasympathetic or rest and relax. Does it sound familiar to people? There's a lot of work, a lot of writing going on in some of the lay literature about the vagus nerve, if people have seen that written. So the vagus nerve is the primary activating component of the parasympathetic. And anytime we do any stress reduction work, meditation, yoga, breath work, whatnot, we're stimulating the vagus nerve to engage in this rest or relax function. The vagus nerve is, you know, what causes us to, right? When you take a deep breath and just feel your body settling in, that's vagus nerve and a bunch of other things doing their job. And our body is constantly having a balance between sympathetic and parasympathetic function. And essentially what happens, the psychoevolutionary stress theory says, is we are constantly in an elevated state, you know, a slight elevated state of sympathetic activation because of the context of our world. 10,000 years ago, our ancestors, you know, on their extended lifelong camping trip, were out in the woods hunting and gathering, and they're listening to, you know, the river and the sound of the wind in the trees, and every once in a while a bear would jump out, or a neighboring tribe, or, you know, a deer would, you know, run, and they'd have to chase it and try and kill it and eat it or whatever. But for the most part, things are pretty mellow, right? If any of y'all are campers or hikers or outdoor people, you know, it's pretty quiet most of the time. And again, that's our baseline. But the world that we live in now is not quiet most of the time. We've got traffic, we've got, you know, these electric lights, which that's a whole other thing in terms of, you know, the flicker rate and all that. But all that is leading us into a sympathetic activation. And we know that this activation of sympathetic system, that is what leads to many of the chronic diseases that we have. It's, you know, elevates our blood pressure, elevates our cortisol, leads to, disrupts our digestion, disrupts immune system function. And so, you know, versus being out in a space like this, where all those things are regulated, normal, at a healthy baseline. Yes?
I wonder if you've ever seen a report of called a commuter report. So here in the U.S., 40 minutes behind the wheel to get from point A to point B.
It's a great, great point. I think about that a lot on my driving commutes versus when I used to take public transportation. And that work may be out there. I absolutely agree. I mean, you know, taking whatever time that is available to you, and this is something I talk to patients about all the time, is how do you find the time to, whatever is accessible to you, engage in more restorative activities? Because, you know, there might be some people out there that are stuck more in parasympathetic than sympathetic, but I don't know many of them. Right? Most people are going to be, you know, if they're not, you know, just right in the middle, and it's a fluctuating middle, right? This is not a static middle, it's dynamic, but if, you know, their average is going to be more over here, how can they do that? Whether it's, you know, taking public transportation rather than driving, if it's making sure when they get home that they don't just go and turn on the TV right away and sit, because that is also stimulating, but, you know, taking that time at the end of their work day or at the end of their day before they go to bed, there's a huge thing I've got in a little bit coming up, screen time and all that and its implications. So turning off the screens before you go to bed. And I'm still old enough, I'm probably, last generation that remembers, before the internet and all of this, but it's like, I remember like reading a book before bed, and that was awesome, and I loved it, and I'm sure y'all have that too, and there's many, many people now that they just, they got a TV in their bedroom, and they just, watch it until whenever, and then they turn it off and go to bed. What is that doing to their elevation of all these things? So that was the nervous system. We also, when we talk about stress, we talk about the endocrine system. You don't have to worry about this really too much. These are more just to show examples of, right, cortisol, the stress hormone, and how it's regulated. General adaptation syndrome. Some people might remember high school biology, right? So Selye talks about, we have an exposure to an event, we react acutely. If that stressor persists over a long period of time, we develop a mode where we can withstand the constant exposure to that thing. We're definitely away from baseline, but we're still functioning. We're still gearing up and, okay, I'm going to get through this. But there's only a limited amount of time that you can do that before you lead to collapse. This is what we call burnout, right? You just got nothing more to give. You can only withstand things for so long. And this is for just a single exposure to a single stressor. The reality is that we all have multiple stressors in our lives, right? It's not just one thing. We've got job stress and relationship stress and money stress and family stress. And if you watch the news, it's whole level of thing on many different levels, right? We've got environmental stress, temperature fluctuations, climate change is a real thing that can stress people out. So all these things add up and can over time wear us out. And that's just part of our world. This bucket here is an analogy that is useful in this regard. This idea of allostatic load. So allostasis is the body's physiologic response to the negative impacts of stress. Allostasis is like a bucket. And all the individual stressors that I just named, they're like individual spigots that are all feeding water into the same bucket. And so, what happens is, we can deal with stress, right? Stuff comes up, we deal with it, but we can only handle it to so much, and all those different things are all putting water into the same bucket. That's why Selye calls it the general adaptation syndrome, because this is a generalized response to specific stressors, whether it's, he did his initial research with rats and exposed them to extremes of temperature and then electrocuted some of them, shocked them, and then did all kinds of, starved them. He found that no matter what the specific type of stress he exposed them to, the manifestations were all the same, ultimately, because the body responds generally, even though the onslaughts are specific. And so that's this bucket, is you've got all these different factors feeding in till the bucket overflows, and that's when we have symptoms. That's when you start getting adrenal fatigue, adrenal failure. That's when you start getting heart failure. That's when you start having that just all of a sudden expression of some weird rash out of nowhere that just like takes over your whole body, and it's like, where did that come from? It's because you've reached capacity, your body can't do anymore, and now it's manifesting symptoms like that. So what some people did, as I said, well, we want to measure these impacts of stress and see how the environment that we're talking about, how it modulates them. How does it affect these stress levels? So this is the field of environmental psychophysiology. It's a very classic study looking at Here they measured muscle tension. They had a couple different measures in the study. I'm just showing you one. And what they did is they exposed people to a stressor. In this case, it was a video of simulated workplace accidents. So like people at a lumber yard getting their hands cut off by a saw. People just all kinds of horrible stuff designed to raise people's heart rate and stress them out. They don't do that anymore. Do you know actually what stress research now, when they want to stress people out to provoke a stress response so they can measure it? No, the news would be a good one. But what they do? They make people do public speaking. It's a standardized format that they go through, and it's a whole thing, but that's the gist of it, is when they want people to stress people out, they make them do public speaking, and then they measure them, and then they do whatever. But anyway, so here they had people watch this video, measure their stress, their stress level went up, in this case muscle tension, but like I said, they measured heart rate too and all this, went up, and then they had people watch one of three different sets of videos. One was the outdoor pedestrian mall, just people walking around, shopping, whatever. One was traffic, just light traffic, downtown. And one was just this nice babbling stream, this brook. And then they measured their blood pressure, their muscle tension, how long did it take to return to baseline, or what did their blood pressure do after the fact. Here, this graph is pretty clear. After 4 minutes, which is the first data point, the pedestrian and traffic videos, they came down because these people weren't watching people get their hands cut off anymore. But then they went back up, after that, because, this is marginally better than watching industrial workplace videos, but it is not what we would call restorative. Whereas the people that are watching the stream, boom, almost back to baseline at the first data point, and stayed down for the entire rest of the thing. This was published in 92. This is one of the first studies to really demonstrate something that is not rocket science, right? Conceptually, this is not difficult. You say, we did a study that showed that sitting and watching a nice stream in the woods is relaxing. That's not a big deal. However, we're talking about medicine. We're talking about healthcare. This isn't just, let's go to the park. I mean, this is, how can we reduce rates of, all of these things? And these are all studies that have been done for all these different metrics. I'm just showing you the muscle tension here, but since that time, all of these things have been shown to be positively affected, which is huge. Now, these might be small changes, right? I'm not saying nobody needs to use medication anymore. Like, you just go out into a park and all your diseases will go away. No one's saying that. But if we're looking at how are people living their lives, if we want to look at an integrative approach to what health is, I can tell you, and I'm a naturopath, right? Nature is what we do. I'm the person in our profession that talks about this. Like when people see my name on my name tag and I go to conferences, like, oh, you're that guy that talks about nature. I'm like, yeah, okay, that's what we should all be doing. It certainly is not talked about in the allopathic profession, much. I shouldn't say it because there are some people that are getting on board, definitely. Actually, there's more MDs that are involved in doing this type of work now and promoting this than there are naturopaths. But that's a whole other story. When you go in for a new patient intake and they're asking you all your questions, what medications are you on, do you smoke, all that stuff. I would be shocked if any of you have ever had somebody ask you, how much time do you spend outside? It just doesn't, maybe. We'll talk later. that's the type of thing that we're trying to promote with this work. It's just these little things that we can shift the conversation to make it more holistic. Not that people need to stop what they're doing already, but just how can we expand the conversation to include simple things that can have a big impact. This is not just outdoor studies or scenes of outdoor nature. This is a study that was done where they looked at indoor nature, specifically houseplants, in an office building. This is a same office. It was just two different wings. You know, you walked in the lobby, and these guys were over here, and these guys were over here. And in one of them, they put up a bunch of plants around the room. And they didn't tell people that they were doing this study about the plants. They said, hey, we're going to be doing a study looking at worker productivity and all these things. So everybody go in, sit down at your computer. We've loaded your computer up with this, I believe it was some type of math problem solving program. And just go and do, solve the math problems, and we just want to see how you'll do. Right? Didn't tell them about, what the variable was. The people in the other room, they've got plants in their room. Right? Nobody knew that. And then they measure their blood pressure before and after. Starting, everybody's blood pressure is the same as you'd expect. Afterwards, drop in blood pressure for the group that had the plants in the room versus the group that did not, their blood pressure is elevated because they're all stressed out about how they did the math test. And again, the important thing about this is that this was blinded. These people didn't know that the plants in the room were even necessarily there. They weren't, they'd never been in this room before. They're like, okay, there's plants on the wall, great, do my math test. It's just the unconscious presence of this and how the plants were affecting their nervous system function. Again, if you go back to the evolutionary part, our brains operate better just when there are natural aesthetics, because it is more like, again, the baseline that our brains are used to operating in terms of how they process sensory stimulation. Pretty cool. And so this is something that I tell people all the time. I'm like, well, I don't have access to nature, by where I live or by where I work, or maybe there are mobility issues where it's like I can't get out into a park, whatnot. What can I do? There are things that can be done indoors in terms of just bringing that in. And it doesn't have to even be actual plants. Here, there's a hospital, and this is kind of sweeping a lot of healthcare design areas of bringing these nature images into healthcare settings. And they find that people have better outcomes, that they're staying in hospital for a less amount of time, that they're, people are less anxious. Right? Typically, you go to a hospital, some of this work has been done in dental clinics. People are typically very nervous. In dentist offices, showing that those rates of anxiety are down in places where the fish tank. You ever been to a doctor's office where there's a fish tank? There's a reason for that. There was a study that showed that having a fish tank in your office lowers people's blood pressure before their visit. Right? And again, that's not conscious. It's not a sign that they're like, we have a fish tank, it will lower your blood pressure, and it's not placebo, right? People just walk in, they're waiting for the thing. Oh, look at the fish. That's gonna help mellow me out. Good stuff. This whole field got started by a study like that in a healthcare setting, but it wasn't by design. It was something they explored. If anybody goes and reads anything about this topic, you Google it or see a movie about it, or there's some documentaries out there. Read anything, they will all reference this study. This is the granddaddy of them all, as it were. Roger Ulrich, who did that other one that I talked about with the video with the hands and all that, he did this one. So what he did is he looked at recovery rates of surgery. It was the same surgery. It's all gallbladder surgeries between a certain period of time in one hospital up in Pennsylvania. And the variable that he looked at was what was the room that people recovered in. So this is back in the late 70s. Gallbladder surgery was still an open surgery. You needed to stay a couple days post-op to let the incision heal and all that. So he looked at what room did they stay in post-operation. You know, all the surgeons were the same, nursing staff was the same, same terrible hospital food, all of that. It was just what was the room that they were in as our variable. Didn't use these two rooms because these two rooms you could see a view of both these environments, but the people that were in these three rooms, the only view they could see out their window from their bed was the park that the, you know, the trees and everything that the grounds that the hospital was on. Whereas the people in these three rooms, the only view that they had was of the brick wall of part of the rest of the hospital. Only variable that anybody could determine. What they found is that for the people in the nature view rooms, they recovered about a day quicker. They used about a third less post-operative analgesics. Right? These people have had open, you know, surgical incision. They're giving them pain meds to manage the pain. But they needed a third less. And in terms of the nurse's chart notes, there's about a third less negative observations in terms of patient is irritable, patient is, you know, feeling anxious, blah, 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 whatever. There's about a third less of these. Just from having this view out the window like we have out here, rather than looking at a brick wall. That's big deal, right? And you know, I'm sure nobody here is in healthcare administration, but when you are, you know, they are very much concerned about bringing costs down. You know, because if you can get somebody out a day quicker, you know, that's pretty significant when you're looking at how many thousands of people go through your hospital every day. That stuff adds up. One of my tangent ideas at some point was doing this work was to focus just on the economics of all of this and get some actual numbers, but I would have to go and get a degree in economics and not going to do that. But anyway, I'll skip over this study real quick because I'm talking an awful lot, but this is another study that looked at four different environments, kind of same idea, but just outdoors, actually bringing people out into these spaces from very natural, mostly natural, some buildings, you know, mostly built, you know, mostly buildings but some trees, and then very built, almost no nature at all. So kind of a spectrum here. And looking before and after at measures of both physiologic measures of stress as well as psychological measures of stress. I got that backwards, but so psychological measures, yeah, people's stress before to after decreased the most in the natural setting. You know, again, this work is not rocket science, but it's how do we quantify it, how do we show it, as well as physiologic measures of stress. This is salivary amylase, it's a proxy measure of sympathetic nervous system function. And here you've got the most built elevating. I like sharing this study it's for a couple reasons. One, it is one of the first that looked at four settings instead of two. And also because I did it. So this is my postdoc that I did this work. So there's a bunch of this work being done in Japan and Korea called forest bathing. And people have seen this. It's in, there's been some articles in the newspaper and online and whatnot. Very similar designs, bring people out into different settings, you know, forested settings versus urban settings. And looking at the data, this one looks at what's called heart rate variability, which is a very common measure of the physiologic stress response. It's a good way of assessing what the nervous system is doing in sort of that, in terms of that sympathetic parasympathetic balance. We won't get into all of that, but Shinrin-yoku is what it's called, forest bathing. And Shinrin-yoku is more than just going out into nature. It really is the word yoku actually, it means more than bathing. It means immersion. It means envelopment. And so it's not just like, oh, yeah, I'm walking in the woods, those trees are nice, but it's a full sensory, you know, almost like mindfulness meditation while being there, like smelling the air and being present and really feeling grounded and connected to the environment around you as part of this experience. This work has been done for, 15 years now, and it's gotten so well supported in Japan, that the Japanese government has actually funded specific places where they call these forest therapy centers, where it is a equivalent of a state park that is funded by their federal healthcare system. It'd be the equivalent of, I don't know what your all's local state park is around here.
Piskun National Forest.
Okay, so what he just said. If that was funded by the Department of Health and Human Services, right? If the NIH said, you should go here because it is healthy for you, and the federal government is telling you that that's a good idea. I think we've got a little ways to go before our federal government is going to do that for us, but it is something that is possible. One of the other things about forest bathing, and probably the thing that people read about the most, is not just the stress reduction like I've been talking about so far, but there is an aromatic aromatherapy quality to this. Chemicals that are called phytosides. Phytosides are terpenes. It's chemicals. It's like mostly the conifers, so you get that pine smell, or cedars, or cypress. When you're smelling that, those are molecules that are coming in. You're absorbing them through the nasal mucosa. That has direct immunostimulatory effects, meaning it is activating your immune system. Specifically. Did I include that? No, okay. Specifically, one of the things that people are most excited about are what are called natural killer cells. This is a type of white blood cell. Natural killer cells, among their many functions in the body, they circulate around the body and look for cancer and destroy it. They are our body's natural cancer modulating regulatory system. Immunotherapy, for people who have heard of that, as a pharmaceutical, it's what it does is it, in part, stimulates your body's own natural killer cell production so your body can go and fight that off while you're getting chemo and radiation and all that. This is doing that just by walking in the forest and getting all those stress reduction benefits and getting the benefits of just physical activity in general. And usually this is done with friends and family, so you're getting the social benefits of all that too. Now, again, no one's saying that people should just, we don't need chemotherapy anymore, just go for a walk in the woods. That's ridiculous. But what people are looking at is how do we get oncologists to start saying, okay, you got your chemo, you've got your radiation. Tomorrow, why don't you go for a walk in the woods and have them be synergistic and help each other. Yes?
I'd just like to say that my personal opinion is walking in the woods alone is much more beneficial to me than going with someone, because going completely alone to the woods.
Sure, absolutely. No, I mean, that's...
For me, at least,
sure.
Maybe not everybody's like that.
Yeah, and that's a great point in terms of individuality.
Yeah.
I mean, I think everyone, for all these things, people need to figure out what works for them. One of the biggest criticisms, I guess, of this work, when it gets presented, is people will often say, for people that are medical-minded and looking at, okay, quantifying these things, is, okay, well, what is nature? When you say, like, oh, well, go out, what is nature? What is a dose? What is the experience? Is it, walking for half an hour, three times a week by yourself in the woods? Is it going to a park where there's other people around, but you still have, with a friend? Is it, how do we quantify that? And those are valid questions from an empirical perspective. But from a clinical perspective, I don't really care. As a clinician, I just tell patients, whatever works for you, it's going to be the thing that works for you. Right? And everybody is individual. I mean, if you want to micromanage and try and quantify all these variables about social connection and past experience and all that, that was one of the things in the study that I did. Mm-hmm. And this one, we were asking people after the fact, like, what were your experiences in each of these settings? And somebody said, oh, well, I got super stressed out in this one, which, we consider on the continuum to be, one of the less stressful ones. It's like, oh, well, why, And his cortisol levels and other things actually reflected that. So, well, why was that? He's like, well, this is the campus of Portland State University. He's like, well, I'm a student, and I've got a term paper due next week. And so the whole time I was sitting on that bench, I was looking at that building, thinking about, the paper that I have due. Not a relaxing experience for him. And so there's all kinds of different things to consider, variables, individual preference, past experience, all that. But yeah, the main gist is, whatever's going to work for you, then do that. So I'm like halfway done with my slides, and I think it's 7:30. yeah, we started a few minutes late, but I'm going to skip over this one. I'll just try it. This one is about bacteria in the soil. There are natural, there's bacteria everywhere, right? There's bacteria in the soil that has a positive, productive association with neurotransmitters in our brain, specifically serotonin, which people may have heard of, being aware of. Serotonin is a neurotransmitter associated with depression. So the postulation, and there's a lot of research that needs to go into this, but the idea is regular exposure to dirt, is getting that bacteria on our hands, gets in our mouths when we eat a sandwich, is stimulating serotonin. That, again, is more baseline, because our ancestors, again, for all of human history, were regularly exposed to dirt. They were regularly exposed to these things compared to the hyper-hygienic, sterile, we got to put, use Purell all the time and wipe everything down, make sure everything's clean, environments that many people are living in now, that could become, that we're making those things too sterile. And we're not exposing ourselves to the types of microbiota, the probiotics people are aware of, right? Huge topic about all this. Talk about that for a long time, too. But this is just one component of that I think is really interesting. Leads to gardening. I could talk for a long time about gardening. All its benefits, obviously getting your hands in the dirt, the psychological benefit of, hey, look, I helped grow that. Right. So it leads to the common phrase some of you may have heard, gardening is cheaper than therapy, plus you get tomatoes. incredible stuff. There's whole bodies of work on therapeutic horticulture and the benefits of that. Community gardening, because then you get to know your neighbors better, and how are your cucumbers doing, and all that stuff brings places together. I think if there's one thing that I would advocate in this whole area that could really change, especially in an urban context, the way people are living their lives and how they're engaging with the natural world and their communities. And I think gardening is a way to go. I don't know what community gardening situation is here in Asheville. I assume it's pretty robust. And this just looks at mental health overall and positive mental health. This idea of positive psychology, which is a field that looks at how, again, when we look at health as a positive quality, how do we engender and embrace, sense of purpose, self-esteem, happiness, joy, vitality, those things that make us feel good. There's a lot of work. All these things have been shown to increase with time spent outside, on average. Again, nothing's absolute. There are a few individuals where it's the worst time they've ever had, but, for the most part, people are, you expose them to the outdoors, they are going to feel better. And for a number of reasons, we'll get to in a little bit. These are two books that have come out on these topics. This one is a little bit older, still good. This one just came out, I think, back in March, maybe. Fantastic. Absolutely phenomenal book. It was very bittersweet when this book came out, because I'm always happy to see this topic getting discussed. And also, this is the book that I was planning on writing. So I was like, but that's how it goes. But it's great. If you're interested in what I'm talking about, I would encourage you to pick this up. She does a very, very nice job of talking about all these things. I'll skip over all this stuff because we're running out of time. This is more of the negative aspect. The other side of the coin from nature exposure is screen time. and how prevalent that is in our society and what that's doing and how it's contributing to nature deficit disorder. There's a documentary, if you're interested in that stuff, what screen exposure does to our brains, specifically teenagers. Woman that made this, she's a physician, she's a pediatrician, and she has teenagers of her own. And so she's interested, just from a health perspective, what is this doing to my kids? They're on their phones all the time, whatever. So she investigated it and made a documentary about it, and it's very well. She's very well done. She's won awards for other documentaries she made. So I'd check that out. It's urban stuff, just more city living, blah, blah, blah. This idea is a really interesting one, kind of related to nature deficit disorder, this idea of solastalgia. This is a psychological term. Solace, comfort, talgia, pain. The pain and distress that comes from the loss of a beloved place. I think probably just the world being the way the world is, we can all think of a place that we had when we were kids that was just really special to us. And, probably many of us, those places are not there anymore. They're a parking lot now or a mall or a condo complex or something. People have started to measure the impact of that. That these losses are real, same as the loss of maybe not another human being, but the loss of a pet maybe, or something like that, which is also very real and has measurable, not just psychological impacts, but ultimately, I don't think they've done these studies yet, but actually, let me talk about it. They have done these studies because I have one here. This looks at mountaintop removal, coal mining up in West Virginia. Look at rates of depression in areas that have mountaintop versus non-mountaintop removal. Adjusting for socioeconomic factors, so it's not just, poor coal mining town, but taking that in out of the thing, mountaintop versus non-mountaintop, showing rates of mild, moderate, and severe depression. The rates of depression in the mountaintop removal communities are higher than the rates of non-mountaintop removal because of the destruction to the environment versus just going down into the mine itself, but you don't see it. That these ecological impacts have a psychological psychological manifestations because it's land. I mean, people, especially people that live rurally, people doesn't matter. This isn't political or whatever. It's like people love their land. Like there's just something, it's a connection that we have to the land, and when that disappears, that's a part of us. There's a whole realm. Anyway, there's a whole area of study called eco-psychology and eco-therapy that looks specifically at these things. How are all these changes that are going on in our world and it happens every day? Every day you see in the newspaper something. What is that doing to us in terms of our own sense of who we are? Because I won't get into it. I'd love to talk about that. That's actually my favorite part of the talk is we define ourselves in part by our environment. If you think about who you are as a person, on some level, if you were to describe that or paint a picture or try and describe it in images, part of that is where you live. Where did you grow up? What did your house look like? Your block that you lived on, that favorite place that you had. Where do you live now? What is the view out of your kitchen window? Like those are, on a psychological level, those are part of your identity. Those are how you construct your idea of this is who I am. And when those things are damaged or destroyed or removed, that affects you like that. And so, part of what this work looks at is, how do we manage it? First, how do we acknowledge it? And this is not something that people really recognize, right? And so how do we start having conversation on these are real things. And again, this isn't political, it's not socioeconomic. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, there's gonna be some connection to this. So why can't we just all acknowledge these things and use that as a mechanism for advocating for a stronger environmental ethic? Let's take care of her, right? Let's take care of our Mother Earth and the parts of her that are special to us as on an individual level, because they impact us personally. Like, you know, the whole other, you know, ecology aspect about the birds and the frogs and the trees and all that, like, don't even worry about that. I mean, that's all important too. But if you're not caring about that, like, at least care about the human aspect of what these things are doing. Like, that's the gist of this work. There's lots of different techniques for doing like a restorative ecotherapy, like how to work with these negative aspects of solastalgia. won't get into all that. I've been talking too much, but gardening is a great one. Like, just getting outside, spending more time outside, planting something, feeling that connection, feeling that growth. Because again, that's a part of you. I know. I've got my tomato plants. I come out every morning. It's like, yeah, they're like a little part of me in a way. Like, if something were to happen to them, I'd take that personally. So like, cultivate that and the benefits of that. Time outside, artwork, painting, nature, photography is great. All these things are beneficial in these ways. This is the one I was talking about earlier about doing this work with vets and PTSD. Very complex condition. What PTSD is, on a simplified level, is we're talking about a balance of sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system function. Basically, PTSD is being stuck in sympathetic, fight or flight, and not being able to come out of it. Right? Typical experience: you have a car accident or whatnot, you get in a fight or flight, right? Adrenaline, all this, and then it passes a couple days later, whatnot. And you come back and you relax and you're able to go back to baseline. What PTSD is, you stay in that hypervigilant state. And that's what leads to, the night terrors and the insomnia and the irritability and the loss of cognitive function and the emotional dysregulation and all of that stuff. What we're finding is, just spending time outside is incredibly restorative. It helps people come out of that state. Because like you said, it's just being alone and being quiet and listening to the wind and the creek. That does something that 10 years of talk therapy is not gonna reach, or might not reach. So this is really exciting. I won't get into the data. I didn't include it here, but this is really exciting. The VA actually is has funded a program for this. It's called the Green Road. It's right next to Walter Reed campus, Walter Reed Army Medical Hospital. I don't know if it's walking distance or it's a few miles away, maybe. I'm not sure. But it's, I think, 3 acres of preserved land that is just for vets and their families to go. And there are benches, and they can go and just sit and chill out and do that work. It's all data from those types of studies. Very cool stuff. It's very cool that the VA is on board with this. Skip over this. This is just other work that's done in places trying to advocate for incorporation in the different healthcare systems. This idea of green exercise, just getting out in nature for your physical activity, has been shown to be more beneficial than the same activity in a gym. So they've measured people, running around a track, or on a treadmill versus running out on a trail, that their post-exercise, heart rate is lower, their cortisol is lower, their emotional state is better, their mood is better, their self-esteem is better, whatnot, just from being outside. There's another thing on the national level, sponsored by the National Parks Department. And so, I think you guys have gotten a sense of the holistic kind of nature of these things, how it touches on a lot of different areas. And I got into this for a lot of different reasons. I mentioned some of them at the beginning, but one of them also is, ultimately an environmental reason for me personally. I'm a nature guy, I like hiking, and I want it to be around for a while. I want future generations to have the experiences that I had. There's this concern that younger generations are not having the exposure that we had, because partly screen time, partly stranger danger, all these different things, but kids are not getting outside as much as they used to. And the problem with that is, if they're not getting outside, they're not getting exposed. If they're not getting exposed, then why would they care? This quote is from Charles Jordan, who used to be the director of Parks Department in Portland. So, you know, if they do not value what they do not value, they will not protect, and what they do not protect, they will lose. You know, we have to get people, all people, adults, children, families, to understand the value of what it is we have and go out and experience it, so that when it comes to a choice of, well, should we keep this keep this wooded lot, or should we put in another strip mall? You know, why should we care if it becomes a strip mall? Let's say, well, because it's beneficial to us, in addition to just keeping it for its own sake. This is all other stuff. This is for practitioners, but he left, so. Just this interrelationship between, you know, health of the individual, having healthy communities, and having, you know, the context. That's what I have to share. I hope some of it was useful, and thank you very much. Cool.